Hello and welcome to Niaga Spotlight with me, Tamina Kausji. Niaga Spotlight goes through the week in business and future affairs. We look at market watch industries as well as analysis in this entire week. Well, today on a future affairs segment, we're looking at the digital economy in Malaysia. Now, did you know the digital economy is actually one of the fastest growing sectors in Malaysia and has actually attracted an impressive 15.7 billion USD of investment in Q3 of 2022 alone? So, taking all of that into account, and especially with the recent tabling of Budget 2024, Malaysia's digital economy is hoping to contribute about 25.5% to the entire GDP of the country. And this is, of course, under the Malaysia Digital Framework. So we're going to be discussing insights as well as strategies for Malaysia's growing digital economy in this Niaga Spotlight platform exclusive, which actually features what it takes to establish a well-designed, functional, as well as profit and job-generating tech park. The focus, laser sharp, this week is on Porto Digital Tech Park. Now, Porto Digital in Recife, Pernambuco State in Brazil stands as a model of implementing a technology park as a driver for broader economic policy. We have the absolute pleasure of having with us in the studios now Dr. Renato Lima de Oliveira with the Center of Technology, Strategy and Sustainability, CTSS, at the Asia School of Business, and visiting Professor Silvio Meira, technopreneur, founder and chairman of Porto Digital Tech Park. Gentlemen, welcome to the Awani Studios. How are you doing this morning?
Great pleasure to be here. Doing very fine.
Fantastic.
Fantastic to be here.
Amazing. So let's get started with the discussion. Prof. Silvio, I of course wanted to start off with what was the origin story behind Porto Digital? It actually began life, of course, as a non-profit, and what makes it such a favorable environment today in this very quick space of just two decades?
Well, first we started with the problem, treating the problem of human capital, which is absolutely essential if you're going to deal with software, which is the focus of Porto Digital. You have to have very high skilled people to do the architecture, the design, the development of code, sophisticated code for international clients that are on top of the global digital economy anyway. We didn't have those clients in the beginning, but we did have the expectation to have those clients 10 mm-hmm. years later. So we started with a people. It was very small in the beginning, just five companies, 46 people. That was the whole of Porto Digital in the 2nd of February of 2000. And then, you know, the first 10 years, we were hoping and we were driving a huge effort of attracting companies to Porto Digital, but at the same time, doing deeper, wider research in computer science and software engineering and design in the universities around Porto Digital. So the first effort was around people and people to understand not only the technologies and the science behind developing world-class software and software applications. Remember that in 2000, we didn't have smartphones. So smartphones came later in the decade, around 2007, became sort of worldwide phenomenon in the 2010s.
Sure.
So in the beginning, it was software for mainframes, software for the internet, of course, and software for laptops and the cell phones, the small cell phones of the time with very tiny games and stuff like that. But we've learned a lot in the first decade. And in the second decade, we started growing. And now Porto Digital is something like 20,000 people and 5 billion ringgit of gross revenue in 306 businesses.
That's amazing. And I love the fact that, as you mentioned, Prof. Silvio, the fact that you decided very early on that the DNA was going to be software. Prof. Renato, on the other hand, Malaysia, of course, has more of a focus on hardware. Now, what would be the best way to move forward with the digital economy, especially expanding it with the allocations that have been announced during Budget 2024?
Yeah. So it's an interesting aspect that Malaysia and Brazil, they have many similarities.
Right.
But in Brazil, it's much harder to be an entrepreneur and working with hardware for a number of reasons, for tax reasons, for hardware, for the infrastructure, and so on. And we tried. We had an industrial policy to promote hardware in Brazil, and it failed. Malaysia has, in a way, is much more integrated in global value chains, has great infrastructure. It already has a cluster of hardware manufacturing in Penang, in other parts of the country. Mm-hmm. So there is also an opportunity in hardware. But Hardware nowadays is really it's a way where you embed code, where you have software of high value operating in this hardware. So to look at it in a more comprehensive way, Malaysia can build upon its hub of hardware manufacturing, aggregate more value, do more stuff, basically upgrade its function within the value chain, and build upon that to do more software, to localize more of a knowledge production, and through that create more spillovers.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it also speaks very deeply to us looking at the way in which supply chains were basically upended during the Russia-Ukraine conflict and also as a result of pandemic slowdowns, right? Prof. Silvio, I really want to focus on how it was that Porto Digital managed to not just survive but thrive even despite the pandemic and the lockdowns. Tell me a little bit more, and perhaps you could also focus on your CESAR, which is Brazil's most innovative R&D institute located in Porto as well.
CESAR started before Porto Digital. It is one of the anchors of Porto
right.
Digital. If you think of Porto Digital like a shopping center,
sure.
which is not, that has
love that
anchor
analogy.
Institutions. It's a sort of parallel metaphor to understand what CESAR is. CESAR, we started, it's an offshoot from the Computer Science Center at the Federal University of Pernambuco, which is the largest in Brazil, has already graduated something like 2,500 MSCs and more than 600 PhDs in computer science. And we started CESAR actually to make sure that the work in research and education at the university had a context that was connected to innovation.
Right.
CESAR was created to attract to Recife complex problems that people, for some reason or another, wouldn't be able to solve in other places, either in Brazil, Latin America, and later in Europe and the United States. So it ended up that CESAR was a seed for Porto Digital.
Ah. Right, yeah, fantastic. So that is the conundrum.
Yeah, because
thank you for CESAR explaining
was
it.
The first innovation institute in Brazil that was at the same time self-sustainable, non-profit, and completely independent from either university or government or anything. So we started it to be something that was a non-profit that could do things in a non-profit view of the world. You know, working in the long run, losing money to do certain kinds of things, because it thought it was part of the policy that the region would have to have, independent of who was in the government or who had such and such mandates to do whatever. So
sure.
It was CESAR and CESAR's thought in the beginning, together with the university, people in government, but not necessarily their government, entrepreneurs, investors, and empresarios, people that already had software businesses in Recife and around Recife, that started Porto Digital in the 2000s. And the way to think about it was that we are here to stay. We
right.
are not going to give this up before, say, two decades, which is where we are these days. So in the beginning, it was something almost impossible, but to start with, because nobody believed we could do it. And we had our own doubts at the time. You know, is that possible at all? But we also had decided that we had to revive the inner city of Recife.
Sure.
Because one of the things that's around Porto Digital is that it's not only about the tech economy. It's about reviving the inner city of the oldest capital of Brazil. Recife is from 1537. And because of the decaying of the sugarcane economy, which was the basis of the economy, not only of the Recife, but of a region of 100 kilometer radius around Recife.
Sure.
That economy had collapsed because part of the production of sugarcane, the plantations went south, the production of sugarcane and methanol went south as well, ethanol and methanol went south, and Recife was left with the what? Sugarcane wasn't there anymore, and the banks that financed it, the port that used to export it, nothing was there anymore. And we started looking at two things at the same time. More jobs for people that wouldn't be employable in the former economy that didn't exist anymore, and in any case was a low-wage economy, and renewing or redesigning, redoing from scratch the center of the city of Recife. That were the sort of aims of Porto Digital in the beginning.
So it's that fantastic hard reset, basically, that became part of the DNA and moving forward to repurpose an entire region.
Yes.
Specifically, but once again, going back to the human element. Now, Prof. Renato, you of course head the Center of Technology, Strat, and Sustainability. So, speaking about the way in which there are opportunities to build that kind of technological prowess for Malaysian graduates, we've also seen some worrying trends when it comes to the fact that school leavers are more and more unwilling to continue on with higher education, let alone STEM education. What opportunities do you see for closing those gaps for our future digital economy workers?
Right, this is critical, and it's really aligned with the mission of Asia School of Business. So we are a global business school in Malaysia, but for the world, in particular with a mission of advancing the emerging world, emerging markets. And when we look at some of the challenges of being entrepreneur, being globally competitive, human resource is critical. So one of the key ingredients of Porto Digital back there in the 2000 was to reverse the brain drain. You had good education, but you didn't have companies to work, to fully utilize those talents. And we sometimes see that in Malaysia. And then you end up with a public policy to create the conditions for companies to be based there, to get a reputation, to have this whole thing about the brand of a cluster. By intervening there, you end up with a successful case. So in the case of how do I use that experience from an emerging market with some of the same challenges of Malaysia,
right?
What do we bring to here? Is that interventions that are one spot, one specific intervention, but without thinking about the ecosystem, they are most likely doomed to failure because all of the pieces need to be there in order for the system to function. So you need to have capital, access to capital or venture capital. You need to have the human resource. You need to have public policies that are supportive to a certain goal in that they are predictable, they are stable, they are iterative. They don't have to be stable in the sense of fixated to the design that it was created, but that they have a way to basically to be able to retest it and move forward. So all of these are also applicable to the experience of Malaysia, where you have many different pieces of an ecosystem, but that it's scattered, perhaps
sure.
too much, it's fragmented. You have several different state agencies that sometimes they have overlapping functions. But if they actually can work synergistically, the potential here is fantastic. The Malaysian students or the international students, including from Latin America that comes to Malaysia, they are really interested in Malaysia as a hotspot for innovation, for entrepreneurship, and from learning all the great things about doing business in Asia and take that to the rest of the world.
So taking the building blocks, you know, bottom up, right? Fantastic. Prof. Silvio, coming back in again to and picking up. So what actually happened during the pandemic lockdowns when it came to Porto Digital? And how were you able to remain productive? And also, what have you noticed about the general trends of the economy for Porto Digital-wise ever since the pandemic lockdowns lifted and now that we're in a complete recovery period?
Right. For tech companies and software companies in particular, distributed, decentralized work was quite easy to start.
Sure.
You know, to be, you know, to have a sort of big bang from tomorrow onwards, everybody's working from home. Why is that so? Because most of the work you do is already global. You know, your clients are spread all over the world, your meetings are virtual, and you try not to travel too much, because even more so because that has cost implications and productivity implications. So we were partially online or nearly totally online, even
already
being a physical tech park in Recife, because most clients are not there. Recife in Pernambuco, the state, is only 2.5% of Brazilian economy. And the whole of the software economy in Brazil is only 1.5% of the global software economy.
Right.
So most of the clients are not in Brazil from scratch. Right. And then we actually managed to be very productive during 1.5 years of lockdown in Brazil. We had a sort of total lockdown in Porto Digital. But then we started to notice that innovative actions were somewhat, difficult to run. If you needed people to get together to understand complex new problems and to find new solutions for old problems, innovation in general diminished quite a lot in terms of intensity, in width, in results proper during the pandemic. We now know this data from many, many studies, from many businesses, large businesses, small businesses. So we started mid last year attracting people back to Porto Digital to the point that today nearly everybody's back at least 3 to 4 days a week. And you don't have any more parking spots at Porto Digital again. So it's impossible to park a car.
Right.
That's not exactly what we wanted, you know, people parking cars. We wanted people in public transportation. But the fact is that we have this side effect from the pandemic that people went from public transportation to private cars.
Yes.
Because
that's
of,
right.
you know, health concerns and so on and so forth. But now we have this, we continued the growth pattern of Porto Digital during the pandemic. We are sustaining it after the pandemic. And I think we learned quite a lot of things because of the pandemic. For example, a number of software security companies, information security companies started in Porto Digital during the pandemic. A lot of people managed to hire a lot of other people from outside Porto Digital, so we don't count these people inside the 20,000 people at Porto Digital now.
Understood.
Take, for example, Cesar. Cesar had people in 5 cities where Cesar had physical bases in Brazil before the pandemic. Now it has people working in 200 cities in Latin America for Cesar. So some companies actually, and innovation institutes like Cesar, learned how to do decentralized distributed work productively. And having said that, I still think, and we have data to prove it, that
right.
if you want to do something really innovative, you need to get people together because of serendipity effects, because of proximity effects, because of the opportunities for the younger ones or the less experienced ones to learn from the more experienced ones, the ones that have much more road in their heads to understand the world, specifically to understand the problems that the world really has, that, you know, the people that just left the university, if they are left alone at home coding or doing design,
sure.
they are going to spend much more time learning. And this learning time happening in lunches, in meetings, in cafes, is precious. And that's one of the reasons why Porto Digital is a compact, central city, opened, tech park. It's not within walls. You know, everybody meets everybody in the streets of the center of Recife in a very small area.
Yeah.
If you measure the distance between the most distant companies at Porto Digital these days, it's a 10-minute walk.
Just a 10-minute walk. And I love the picture that you're painting because what it speaks to me and tells me is that you've got all these fresh graduates, Gen Z most likely, and they've got a huge host of passions, a lot of them focusing around some of the biggest crises of our time. Of course, there's the climate crisis, the sustainability, and how to actually bring those bright minds into STEM solutions or anything related to technology, right?
Yes, because then you have Porto Digital has something like 600 PhDs in computer science spread all over, 300 companies. And then you have maybe 500 MSCs in computer science as well and design. And then you have thousands of graduates, undergraduate degree holders in electronic engineering, software engineering, computer science, information systems, and so on and so forth. And in a city that's it basically has the same altitude as Kuala Lumpur.
All right.
We're at sea level in a marshland, basically, and whatever happens in or is related to sustainability mm-hmm. in the wider world affects Recife.
Absolutely.
So we have all
that
sorts
ecosystem.
All sorts of ESG concerns, from including more people to working with the environment around us to make it more sustainable. So that's in the core of Porto Digital's policies and in the long run as well, because we want to be there in 200, in 500 years' time.
Yeah, absolutely, and you're building that framework.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Prof. Renato, so from ESG moving into 5G networks, metaverse, so the next digital wave is absolutely upon us. In your opinion, how can Malaysia best prepare for such innovation in digitalization by harnessing and leveraging on internet connectivity? Official data, of course, shows we are getting closer to that ideal, the 100% connectivity. But there's also reliability of internet that you have to be able to ensure, right?
Right, and for example, we still have under-penetration of actual users of 5G.
Sure.
And that has been quite complicated public policy discussion in Malaysia about having a state company deploying the whole infrastructure and then with companies subscribing and so on. It just shows that the public policies do play a large role in actual use of technology, access, and so on. So all of that is a key point. I'll give another example based on research that we do at Asia School of Business at the CTSS, our research center. With the team at CTSS, we did a collaborative research project with colleagues from US, from MIT, from Brazil, from Turkey, about technology adoption in upper middle income economies. So we, and in particular, IR 4.0, all of these advanced manufacturing, we know that in advanced economies, the typically highly developed countries like Germany, Switzerland, or United States, you cannot compete on labor-abundant kind of manufacturing. In Malaysia, you still have a lot. In Brazil, you still have some. In Turkey, you still have as well. So the route of technology adoption is actually less predictable than in advanced economies. It's just you cannot survive being a manufacturer in a country that you have to pay extremely high salaries without actually being extremely productive. Malaysia still has a manufacturing park that's heavily dependent on abundant labor with relatively low wages.
That's right.
So we did a study on how is technology, IR 4.0, being adopted in the country, and we have seen that there is a strong drive towards that. However, not necessarily the required investment in human capital. The required investment in human capital is extremely essential to actually use all of the new capabilities. So when you put IR 4.0 type of technologies where machines can talk to each other and then they can point information for users to actually be able to debug it, to solve it, or to rejig machinery automatically, you need to have a kind of skilled labor that is not the line operator. It's a problem solver. It's someone that it's working with the computers, with the data generating process and advancing the manufacturing capabilities. And here is one challenge. We have seen companies and we've seen good policies to promote the capital investment, but the human capital investment, sometimes the company cannot internalize. Sometimes you are relying on foreign workers that are guest workers that you're not necessarily going to train them for them to leave in 1 year and so on. So this is a point that we document on the basis of research, that it requires tight integration, tight coordination to fully exploit the benefits of technology for the development of the Malaysian economy.
Yes, absolutely. I think you've spoken really well on the need to focus on those who are knowledge workers more than just, you know, filling in the lower rungs of technology. Thanks for that. Prof. Silvio, Renato, we take a quick break now. We'll be right back with Niaga Spotlight. Don't go anywhere.